WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Talking about race is one of the most difficult endeavors in America, writes David Shipler in his new book, A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. He says, shouting is easy, muttering and whining and posturing are done with facility, but conversing, black with white, white with black, is a rare and heavy accomplishment. To research his book, Shipler, who is white, crisscrossed the country over a 5-year period, talking with blacks and whites about race. He wrote a similar book 21 years ago about what Jews and Arabs in Israel thought of each other. That book, Arab and Jew, won a Pulitzer Prize. Shipler was a New York Times reporter for over 20 years in New York, Saigon, Moscow, Jerusalem, and Washington. I asked about the stereotypes he found whites have now about African Americans.
I got some pretty tough answers, striking answers from many people. The images and stereotypes that many whites have of blacks are very negative. They have to do, for example, with the body, the skin color, facial features, hairstyles. I mean, there were whites who told me that when a black wears braids or wears African dress or is dark skinned, they feel less affinity for that person. They feel more distance. They feel a little wary and even a little afraid. There are a whole set of stereotypes having to do with the mind. For centuries in this country, blacks have been seen as less intelligent, less capable than whites. There were stereotypes having to do with morality and immorality, a notion that blacks are sexually aggressive, that their families are disintegrating, that they don't care about their children as much. There were images about violence, which are very powerful. So all of these images would come out when you really ask the right questions of whites.
Did you ask African Americans if they had racist feelings toward whites?
I did indeed, and I got quite a lot of those too. I mean, one story that one college student from Washington, D.C. told me was that, and she told it laughingly, was that you shouldn't go near any white person who's been out in the rain because his or her hair will stink. And I had never heard this before, but it fit into a pattern of many blacks looking at whites as unclean, having poor hygiene, which, of course, is the flip side of white stereotypes of blacks as dirty. And then there are other stereotypes that many blacks have of whites also having to do with mental ability, that, you know, that whites may be smarter, but they're less wise. They have less street savvy. They don't, think through the implications of their actions as much, that they're immoral because they have no empathy or feeling for people who don't have as much power as they do, and so forth.
You've reached the conclusion that white people and African Americans don't listen well to each other, and that in fact they often speak a different language when it comes to discussions about race. Give me what you think is maybe the most compelling example of that.
Well, there are so many, it's hard to pick one out, but I'll tell you one particular example that I think is a telling one. I have a friend who is a newsman, a reporter, and he was writing a story on Somalia, and he had to write a summary of the story first. And in the summary, he mentioned that there was a tribal conflict in Somalia. A black reporter who read the summary went to a white editor and objected to the word tribal, thinking that it was derogatory about blacks and Africans. The white editor went to the right reporter and said, maybe you should change this. And the white reporter was very angry and said, this is a perfectly legitimate anthropological term, and I think that I should use it. And he was also angry that the black reporter hadn't come directly to him, but had gone to the white editor. And so the white editor insisted that it be changed. And so the white reporter changed it to Byzantine conflict or Byzantine politics. And another white editor who didn't know about all of the background read the summary and said, don't you think it would be better to use the word tribal? So they went round and round again. It came out in the paper as murky. So when the reporter told me this story, the white reporter, I said, well, did you talk to the black reporter about this? Because it sounds like a genuine misunderstanding here. The black reporter thought you were making something of a racist comment, and you thought that the editor and the black reporter were being politically correct and censoring you. He said, well, it's a good idea. Maybe I should talk to them. So a couple of weeks later, I asked the white reporter, well, did you have that conversation? He said, no. He said, I just was afraid I'd get angry. There's another example that comes to mind, which is more serious in a way because it happened inside a family. I was interviewing a couple who had been married about 25 years. He's black, she's white. Just before they were to get married, her brother and his wife came to her and denounced her and said, what are you trying to do, kill our father? You know he'll have a heart attack if you marry a black man. And then 5 years later, her brother came to her and said, I'm really sorry. That was the most shameful thing I ever did. I apologize. Well, she told me this story with her husband, her black husband, sitting beside her. He then said to me, but her brother never apologized to me. And all of these years, I've gone to family holidays with the big hugs and all that, and I've had this in the back of my mind. He never apologized to me.
As you point out time and time again in your book, it's very difficult for whites and African Americans to talk together about race and to understand what the other is saying. One proposed, well, not solution, but help for this is diversity training. And a lot of corporations have been doing this, hiring professional diversity trainers to come in and do kind of like sensitizing workshops for whites and for African Americans to understand each other's cultures better and to be able to talk about these issues in a way that everybody can communicate. You, I think, visited a lot of these diversity sessions around the country. Yeah, give me an example of what you think was good and unsatisfactory about them.
I think the good aspects of diversity sessions are many. I think the bad aspects exist and have to be dealt with. The negative aspects first. The negative aspects sometimes are that people feel that they're being preached to and that they're being accused of being racists. And I don't think most people think of themselves as racists and don't want to be thought of that way. Some diversity trainers are unskilled and don't know their audience very well. A lot of preparation is needed for a good diversity training session. It has to last more than half a day. When the sessions are good, the ones I went to were very good. I went to one that went for 5 days for middle managers at AT&T and DuPont, and they were all brought to a hotel near Dulles Airport in Virginia, away from their own families, and they went from 8 in the morning till midnight. I mean, it was an intense thing. What the diversity session was composed of was a series of educational lectures and films, plus workshops that where people were broken up into like-minded groups or similar groups. That is, at one point, all the blacks would be together and all the whites would be together separately. They would talk about their own experiences, and then they would come back into the larger group and talk about what they had discussed. One thing that came out, for example, in one of them was very powerful. A black woman who was about 50, I would guess, stood up and started to talk about how the day that the not guilty verdict was rendered in the trial of the policeman who beat Rodney King in Los Angeles, she came into work and nobody spoke to her. No whites spoke to her about it. She was very upset, but nobody said anything to her. And she'd worked there for years with these people. And she started crying as she talked about this. Afterwards, some of her white coworkers came up to her, comforted her, talked to her, and began to discuss these issues in a way that she really wanted them discussed. I think that it was probably a pretty therapeutic moment because suddenly she was a human being with feelings, and suddenly race was on the table so that in the future when things happen like this, I would guess that the whites and the blacks will find a way in that particular office to discuss them in a you know, healthy fashion.
Some people say that the real issue in America, the real divisive issue, isn't so much race as it is class. The class is really the problem, and I wonder if you'd agree with that.
I think both are true. I think class and race are both very serious problems. Obviously, they're related in the sense that more blacks are in poverty than, you know, that's a percentage, higher percentage of blacks than whites are in poverty. Not more in sheer numbers, but higher percentage, almost 30%. But I think that there's something else going on that's important to recognize. Even though many blacks have moved into the middle class, if you measure annual income, the difference in net worth is enormous between blacks and whites. The median net worth of white families in America is $43,800. The median net worth of black families is $3,700. If you take just those earning between $25,000 and $50,000 a year, whites have a median net worth of $44,000, blacks $15,000. What that says is those blacks who've moved into the middle class, if you measure by income, are hanging on by their fingernails, and they're vulnerable and they're scared, because any economic downturn will hit them very hard. In addition, I think it's important to understand what happens inside workplaces once blacks get in. Integration, you know, has been an ideal of this society ever since the civil rights movement. But integration really means sharing power. And by that measurement, we have not had much integration in America. We've had it in the military. But in most other institutions, it hasn't taken place. I remember talking to a black guy who worked for IBM, and he told me that he was working there for a long time before he realized that at the end of every workday there was a happy hour at a nearby bar where all the white workers would go and make deals and plan strategy and do business. And he didn't even know about it. He wasn't included in it. So there are invisible walls that are erected even once blacks are inside the company or inside the institution.
I think there's a lot of institutions, whether it's schools or corporations, where although there is mathematically a mix of whites and blacks inside the group, there's a lot of separations. The whites sit here, the blacks sit there. The whites socialize here, the blacks socialize there.
Yes, that's right. In fact, I open A Country of Strangers with a scene in a high school in Brooklyn, where in the hallways, the kids are all mixed up together. And then in the cafeteria, there's a table all of blacks, a table all of Cambodians, a table all of Russians speaking Russian, and so forth, Latinos. And the kids actually spent some time with me drawing a map of the school and showing me where in the school different groups clustered during free periods. And they were clearly mostly along racial and ethnic lines, although then there was the theater crowd over here and the newspaper crowd over there. You know, people tend to pull together when they have common interests as well as common backgrounds. You know, when I started the book, I really was totally opposed to the idea of black dormitories in colleges. I thought it was a terrible mistake. And I'm still not wild about the idea, but I understand it better. I sat down with some black students at Colgate who were talking about the subtle and explicit racism they encountered in that mostly white school in upstate New York. And finally, a couple of them said, you know, when I was, you know, they were, you know, they went to high schools with mostly whites. They had mostly white friends, some of the black students. And they, you know, they said, but, you know, when we could, at night, we could go back home. You know, we could go back to our families, and there we could be ourselves. We could be completely relaxed. And they said, you know, if we didn't have this black dorm to retreat to, we really couldn't stay here. I think it's important to understand that blacks in America need that comfort zone, many of them, not all, of course. The problem comes where pressure is put on blacks to stay only with other blacks and not make friends or hang out with whites.
My guest is David Shipler. He's the author of the new book, A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Shipler, author of the new book, A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. Now that you've finished this book about black and white communication in America, what do you see differently than you did before about yourself or your own perceptions?
I understand more clearly than I had before that despite the fact that my family was very open-minded and anti-racist, that my head was filled with what diversity trainers call tapes. And the tapes play. And they're tapes of bad images, negative stereotypes of black people. In all the interviewing I did with whites, no white told me anything that I had not already heard about stereotypes of blacks. Somewhere back in my subconscious, even, these had been registered, which leads me to think that although it's conventional to say that little children have to be taught to hate, that in America it's really the other way around. Children have to be taught tolerance. By virtue of growing up in America, you absorb the prejudices. And I'm not even sure I can identify their sources very easily, but they're there. Now, I think, I hope, I put them aside and I put them in a box and I don't act on them. But I can tell you that as I listen to white people talk to me, and as I listen to blacks tell me about their experiences with whites, these bigoted images got activated in my mind. They were familiar to me. I'm very honest with you when I say that I have harbored a lot of these views.
Like what?
The reactions to skin color, to facial features, to hairstyles, the notion that blacks are less intelligent, that they don't work as hard, that they're not as competent. Violence is certainly one that's been in my back in my mind quite a bit. Morality issues. I think power questions. I mean, it's very unusual in America for whites to accept completely openly the notion that black people can have power over them. Richard Arrington, the mayor of Birmingham, told me his white staff often gets questions, what's it like to work for a black man? The idea that blacks can have power over you is still, in many parts of America, an alien idea. That concept was there in me, I guess. I mean, I recognized it when people talked about it. So this is not an autobiography that I've written, but it is very autobiographical in the sense that you're right. I'm a white person in America. I can read between the lines of white America, and I can look past all the dissembling and denials that many white Americans make into the heart of bigotry.
Do you think one of the problems about talking about whites in America is that there are whites who are much more privileged than other whites? I mean, there are whites in the upper middle class and the upper class and the middle, and then there's other whites who are unemployed or on welfare or, you know, have lived in crummy neighborhoods all of their lives. The families have lived in, you know, those neighborhoods for generations. Sometimes I think we see whites as being too monolithic.
Yes, I think that's very correct. And I mention that and write about that a bit in the book, because many whites cannot imagine seeing themselves as privileged. Because they don't feel privileged at all. They feel also that they're struggling, and that, in fact, they look around and they see blacks getting the ostensible privileges of affirmative action, even though they may not be quite as, whites may not be quite as discriminated against in that regard as they think. It offends them. So that's an issue, I think. There's no question about it, yes. And it makes it more difficult to say to whites what needs to be said, which is that, as Peggy McIntosh of Wellesley put it, as whites all carry around an invisible knapsack of privilege. We're not aware of it, but our white skin really gets us things that others don't get. If I may tell you one quick story about this. I was at a workshop in Washington, and this is one of the most effective exercises in diversity training that I saw, where the trainer asked a series of questions. We were supposed to answer them by standing. And he said, one of the questions was, I have never been denied the use of my credit card because of my race. And only the whites in the room stood. And we were left standing there for a long time looking at each other, with the blacks and Latinos and Asians also looking at us. I have to leave my culture at the door when I go to work. Only the non-whites stood. And then there was the searing question, which I end begin the last chapter of the book with. I've considered not having children because of racism. And a small group of black and Latino women stood. And that was a shocker, because I had never thought to ask that question of anyone, even in all my research. And that's why I say that you never stop learning about race. Nobody's an expert. This question came at the very end of my research. I was floored by it, the answer to it, and I still think there's a lot for me to learn on about this subject, and a lot to explore in terms of the gap between black and white.
Do you live in a neighborhood that has much of an African American or Latino population in it?
No, my next door neighbors are a mixed couple, actually. She's black, he's white, and a kid across the street is black, although he's grown up now and he's gone off in his own life. But essentially, the neighborhood I live in is very white, yes, very white.
Is that sometimes something that you feel you're supposed to apologize for?
No, I don't apologize for it. I regret it, though. I mean, I grew up in an all-white town in New Jersey, Chatham, and I feel that was a real disadvantage. And in college in those years, there were very few whites. In fact, the first black person I ever had a discussion of race with was Martin Luther King. When he was up at Dartmouth giving a speech, I worked for the college radio station, and I interviewed him. It wasn't really a conversation. I asked him questions, and he talked. And when I reflect on this, I think this is really remarkable as an example of my disadvantage, because I think a person, especially nowadays, who grows up in an all-white situation goes out into the real world with a real handicap. That's why I'd say that at colleges, students have a great opportunity that many of them miss. To learn a lot about people who are different from them. This goes for blacks as well as whites and Latinos and Asians, you know, everyone who clusters together. It's a great opportunity, and it's an important education, because the world in this society in America is never going to be overwhelmingly white in their futures as they go into their adult lives.
Well, David Shipler, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us about your book.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
David Shipler is the author of the new book, A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.